Welcome, everyone, to the Farm CPA podcast presented by Top Producer. I'm Paul Niefer, and today I am joined by Ben Rinchie from, if my memory's right, Ben, you're near Jessup, Iowa. Do I have that correct, or did I mess that up?
No, that's right. We're at Jessup, specifically Jubilee.
Okay. And I think your weather... I was doing an interview with Bill Northey yesterday he's over in Des Moines, but he was saying the weather looked pretty nice. Are you guys having pretty good weather right now?
Excellent. We've had a week in the field. We've got most of our fertilizer application done. We've got anhydrous ammonia, which is a primary source of nitrogen for us on the ground. Few guys have thought about planting. Of course, everybody's hooked up in the early soybean planting craze. There's a few guys that have soybeans in the ground for the first time. but it's really not warm enough here to plant. Soil conditions are good. It's a leap of faith that, you know, your seed's going to lay in cool, dry soil until it warms up. But no real fast warm up in our forecast.
Well, and I know Northwest Iowa seems to be a little bit dry. Are you concerned about Eastern Iowa yet being dry, or is it still in pretty good shape?
You know, it takes months and months to get dry, and it takes 15 minutes to get wet. So I'll take the dry to put the crop in, Paul.
Yep. Well, why don't we start off with do a brief description of your farm operation? You know, when did it start? What the current structure is, and then maybe how it's managed and so on. We'll start off with that.
Sure. Well, I tell you what, Paul, our family came from a little place outside of Hanover, Germany, outside of in the neighborhood of Barrenbusch, outside of where the Lutheran Church is at Pittson, and moved here in 1855. And if you go look at the benefactors of our little country Lutheran Church, we've been marrying our cousins for at least two centuries now. So we... The genesis of our farm has come in the last 100 years. Till then, our farm was always the same, a diversified farm with, you know, four or five kinds of crops and four or five kinds of critters. But then specialization started 100 years ago, and we were dairy farmers. Like everybody in the community, we had a big dairy stanchion barn with hay storage above it. Fed skim milk to the pigs, raised poultry on the side, had sheep to eat the bottom leaves off the corn. And we did that. Then the tractors arrived and commercial grain production started. My grandfather in the late 50s figured out that he could move into the beef cattle business with a lot of the assets that he had as a dairy farmer. That bovines were bovines, and some of the things moved over, haymaking equipment, forage equipment, things like that. My dad followed that model, fed cattle, and then greatly expanded our hog finishing operation in the 70s and 80s. By the 90s, I joined the farm and took our grain production model up a step. So, you know, in 160 some years since the family got here, and 100 years that our direct farm can trace itself back to my grandfather. We've never done the same. We've always been evolving. We've always been changing. Right now, we're a grain operation, and we do a fair amount of specialty custom work.
When you say specialty custom work, what type of custom work would that might be?
Well, we like all the skill jobs. We offer a variety of things. We put up commercial size fertilizer facilities. We have greatly improved our grain drying and storage business. Harvest, of course, we've got a truck fleet available. We want to do the things that just aren't off the rack, that we not only have the service, we don't only have the field operation to sell, but we can do the service too. And we're looking at our commercial competitors who offer those services to everybody. And we We offer more like a speakeasy. If you know the back door to knock on, we'll do them for you. We want just a few low maintenance customers to spread our fixed costs on rather than, you know, run a coffee shop and invite everybody over to, you know, do small fields and lots of different products on things. So we're spraying, fertilizing, drying corn, storing corn, moving grain to the market. Those are the things we're doing.
Okay. And I think that's a good thing for farmers to understand is that you do have a certain amount of fixed costs, you know, equipment, et cetera. And the more that you can provide services to soak up some of that fixed cost, you know, the more of that that's going to drop to the bottom line. Now, I know your current, you have a brand, I'm going to say, because I've been to your farm a couple times now, you have a branding. What is your brand for your farm and how did that evolve?
Oh, we call ourselves the Blue Diamond Farming Company. And, you know, there's a story behind that, of course. But my favorite way to explain it is like this. If you've ever been to the grocery store and ate the delicious Blue Diamond almonds and walnuts and things like that, we think of ourselves as the other nut farm. But I'll wait for you on that one, Paul. But honestly, 30 years ago, I bought a used truck and it was decorated with blue diamonds on the side. And we got it home. And that was the year that we started farming over a much wider footprint. We'd actually had a chance to take over some land almost 100 miles from home, outside of our normal geography. And if you've ever looked at how you spell the name Rinchi, you know, it was a good portion of first grade to learn how to spell that. And they couldn't spell our name or had no idea how to spell our name at the grain elevator when we made deliveries. So they started writing Blue Diamond on the tickets and it kind of stuck. And, you know, it's not the worst thing to take your family name out of your business. When the EWG screens you, things don't pop up as fast when your name isn't involved. When you employ people, if we did business as Rinchi Farms, people assume, well, I'm not a Rinchi. I'm not going to be important. But I'm Ben Rinchi. I'm the owner and manager of Blue Diamond Farming Company. We have a shop foreman. My son-in-law, Luke Gossi, farms with me now. Luke's, you know, proud of his family tradition, and we didn't have to change the name of the business because Luke's here. So there's a lot of people that are very, very important to our farm, and they're not all last name, surname Rinchi, and we, it's a good thing.
Is your structure now, are you under one umbrella or have you maybe taken advantage of some LLCs to put, let's say, the trucking in the LLC and the grain storage in the LLC, or is it just all under one umbrella?
Well, Blue Diamond Farming Company is really a DBA and just doing business as, and it covers several ventures like that. It covers my own personal business. It covers things I do together previously with my father and now with my son-in-law, Luke Gossi. It covers an alliance we have with another farm that we merged and included in our operation, and that's Picket Fence Family Farm.
Okay.
And then, of course, we've got a sophisticated estate planning strategy that involves intentionally defective trusts and it gives us a good blanket for everything.
Okay. And you'd already mentioned that it sounded like, what, about 20 some years ago, you had an opportunity to go about 100 miles away. What is that? I think my memory is that's north, so you have a little bit different season. Is that part of the appeal? Is to have a little bit, you're able to extend your season, or just go over a little bit over how that came about, what works well, maybe what doesn't work well on that type of situation.
Sure. Well, you know, I never anticipated being a farmer once I left the farm. I tried it once when I was 18 and I bought some expensive land in the early 80s. High interest rates and declining farmland values just about canceled me out. So I ended up in college. I went for a short course to learn to, you know, just take the ag classes, and Iowa State claimed me, and I ended up getting a four-year degree. My mom and dad never expected me to take the college like duck to water, but I went there and did pretty good. And they told me, stick around. You're not missing a thing on the farm during the 80s. I got to the end of farming and they said, no, still don't need to come back. So I thought about what I could do to maybe get ready to farm someday. And I got a job at a bank. I worked at a bank a little while and decided I needed some more background. So I got an MBA. And then I did that until 1993. Unfortunately, I lost my younger brother in a harvest time accident who was farming with my dad. And so I made an instant decision to come back to farm. Yeah. So then, to your point, asking about farming farther away from home, you know, I came back to the farm with a little different situation than a lot of my best friends who farm. The one where they got out of college and weighed whether they could do something else, and they thought about it and came back to the family business, and mom and dad moved to the little house, and they got the big house and lived on the home farm and all that. Very different for me. I had success in a career in finance. I had a very ample income for someone my age. I can't say I had a briefcase of money like some people thought I did coming from the bank, but I did have my own credit raising and ability to raise capital by borrowing it from banks. And I do speak fluent banker from that experience, that first decade in my career where I worked in banking. And so I came in at a very different spot with my dad because I felt I'd been successful at something else and I had my own money. And my dad just passed last summer. He was 90 and he farmed until a few months before his passing. He never turned over any family business for me. I needed to find my own opportunities. This past year is the first year that I've really had any family land that I had to farm. I had to find opportunities and I couldn't wait for them to happen, you know, what I can see off the front porch of my home. So we knew of an opportunity to farm land 100 miles away. And I was a business analyst for a decade and alone, you know, the big banks have a much different structure than what farmers are generally used to dealing with country yep. banks. You know, they have management yep. teams that call on, but my job was to figure out whether companies made money in cash flow and then later on to call on them and sell those, you know, financial products to them. Well, looking at farming, one thing, you know, one of the deadly sins that I saw farmers always do was pick up too many fixed assets because you can't buy 1.3 combines when you need it. You either right. have to have one combine or two combines. You can't pick up 2.2 sprayers. You have to have two combines or three sprayers.
Right.
And so I saw an opportunity to use equipment further down the road on a slightly different weather pattern and a slightly different season than us. And you're right. Our initial move was to go north, closer to Minnesota. And then in the category of I'd rather be lucky than smart, a lot of things happened. In 1994 in northern Iowa, believe it or not, there were not great hybrids and varieties that were shorter season. And a lot of that land had not been farmed by as aggressive of farming operations as what we've got at home. And there was a lot of land that could be greatly improved in its productivity by adding drainage tile. And you could expand your operation a great deal by putting a little spit and polish on things. Not everybody had the budget to fix waterways, clear out old trees, remove rocks. not everybody had moved from a diversified farming model with several kinds of crops and critters, which isn't a bad model, by the way. It's just that when you specialize, you often pick up the newest technology and improve your performance. And, yep. We did that expansion at the time where precision agriculture came of age, and all these things, better yields, better farming environment from improving the land, better technology and the equipment we use, ethanol came of age. Even a blind squirrel finds a nut. Yeah. And it turned out there was some serendipity to it. And it was a real boost to be able to spread fixed costs and find other places to farm with our equipment while other people use their fixed assets for a few days and parked it in the shed.
When you logistically, when you move your equipment 100 miles away, are you trucking it, or are you just simply attaching something to the back of the tractor and going down the road? Because I've heard both, and I was just curious how you guys do it.
Well, you would think, you know, that question gets asked a lot by farmers who only farm from what they can see from the front porch. For a long time, our farm was barbell shaped, a big barbell down here and then a long skinny neck up to a second operation. But what happens is, if you're expanding, we picked up things along the way. So trucking, first of all, most larger farm equipment doesn't fit on trucks very well.
Nope.
So the answer is we drive it. And,
okay.
And 24 and 36 row planters and big tillage implements and things like that don't hop right on a trailer and go. A combine arguably does, but it's not as easy as you think. And then you have to have a truck to move it. And
yep.
At the time of year, you want all your trucks on a grain hopper pulling grain. And you got to deliver the truck, the combine, and then you probably want to bring that truck home, and you need an operator. You know what? Just get up 2 hours early, grab a good cup of coffee, and get going.
Yep.
And, we do a lot of gravel travel. If you know the road system in northeast Iowa, most of this farm equipment on a good dry day travels down a gravel road just as fast as it does down a highway. And most of our equipment is almost to the point where it's like a good old horse. You could just crack the reins and take a nap and it'll get you home, you know?
Yeah.
Some of our equipment can almost figure out its own route to get there.
It can almost auto steer. You know, that day will be coming.
So, that has been done, that someone recorded in it what our smart farming system would call an AB line, and has saved it. Unfortunately, AB lines don't stop at stop signs, and they don't watch out for other motorists and things like that. But we have recorded the AB line a long ways there. So
now you had mentioned your grain system, and I remember, I think the first time I got a tour of your farm is when Chris Barron and I had come over when you were first building the grain system. Matter of fact, I remember you took us inside, I think, the big bin, and I remember, man, I could play basketball inside of this grain bin and have room left over. What was your impetus for doing the grain system, and what do you think you've done well with it? Maybe what would you do over, if anything?
Well, the impetus is I wanted to be competitive in my area and differentiate myself. And, I marvel when I go on social media and you read about, farmers who are enjoying the current higher price grain and buying a lot of shiny new iron and you just kind of cringe thinking, man, you're increasing your cost structure on something that could be very, very temporary for
yes.
you right now.
Yes.
Yep. You know, just enjoy it for a year and then think about making the capital expenditures would be my unsolicited advice here, Paul. But, the very charm period we had a dozen years ago, you know, that kind of 2008 through 2013 era where we had much higher grain prices for a little while.
Yep.
And, you know, I didn't want to spoil it all on just buying more productive capacity to raise more corn and more commodity soybeans. I just wanted to make myself a little more strategic. And so, you know, I basically pulled out my old banker hat and decided, what do we need to be more competitive in our area? Well, first of all, harvest is a lot of work during a period where it's getting shorter days and colder weather.
Mm-hmm.
And so I wanted to make our harvest much easier. And second, we're, you know, there's two corn crazy towns in the United States, Decatur, Illinois, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa, that need a million bushels of corn a day to make everything they do. Mm-hmm. And we're 40 miles down the road from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And there's a real benefit, I'll say, to being a just-in-time supplier to all the users of corn in our area. So we'd already gotten mobile and had a truck fleet, but we needed to be delivering that corn. I'd actually tried to emulate another producer that's gone super asset light, that hires all his trucking done and doesn't have any storage and delivery. And I realized that there were some real benefits to that, but that was tooled to his production area. Mm-hmm. My production area, to get ready for it, I needed to be store that corn outside of harvest, learn to be a better grain merchandiser myself, and roll hedges, capture the carry, and more importantly, just deliver at the exact moment that the end user wanted that grain. And so it was kind of the perfect storm. In that charm period of 08 through 13, my balance sheet had done nicely as a land buyer. I had a lot of market equity on my balance sheet, and I know that's not cash flow, but I knew that spending literally millions and millions of dollars on a grain system wouldn't warp my balance sheet out of shape. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had the asset base to go do it. Second, not everybody has people like you, Paul, that manage their taxes for them. And so they pay a lot of taxes. And I'd like to thank the generous taxpayers of the United States of America through the FSA for having very low interest money that I can borrow to build the grain setup. Mm-hmm. In fact, my borrowing costs are almost benign. And so I thought, you know, I've got the balance sheet to do it. This is the bottleneck on the hourglass for us. We need to increase our harvest capacity. We're selling way too much wet corn out of the field. Believe it or not, corn production, because the way people have moved up planting, because of better management, because of varieties, there's more dry corn out of the field. But once out every 4 or 5 years, you get a super wet corn yield, and wow, you get walloped on dry across.
Yep.
We needed to have much larger corn drying capacity. And so we put up the system so we can do all those things, service our best end user, reduce our drying costs on extreme wet years. There's some science out there that thinks there's something called phantom yield loss, that if you harvest early and dry it, you do better than letting it dry in the field. And I think there's something to that. I can't give you more than empirical evidence for that, but we think that earlier harvesting has great benefits. Earlier harvesting led it the way to more corn on corn in our area. Corn usually is a little more profitable than soybeans for us, although I can't say that's always a given, especially as expensive as farm machinery is right now. We've moved back closer to a 50-50 rotation simply because we can farm machinery is out of control, expensive, and we can just grow soybeans with a whole lot less tractor time and harvest time. So the machine costs are huge, and we want to avoid overextending ourselves or changing our cost structure to raise a lot of corn at this moment. Please go ahead, Paul.
I was going to say, I remember the when I get to operate a combine, and I used to say drive a combine, but I've had a few farmers, chew me out because you don't drive a combine, you operate a combine. But that's what I typically call it. I got to admit.
Let me ask you this, Paul.
Yeah.
I know where you're from. You're from Washington, correct?
Yep. Yep.
What do you say when you harvest corn?
What do I say when I harvest corn?
Yeah. What's the verb?
You got me at a loss here. I'm thinking, well, harvest
well.
Well,
you're better than most, Paul. You're better than most, because most of my friends from the Palouse or the Camas Prairie out there will say that we're going to go cut corn. Well, you cut corn for silage, for grain. You pick or shell corn. You pick corn. That is when you picked it on the ear, or when the revolution came that you could have a sheller attachment on your tractor-mounted picker, you could shell it. So you pick or shell corn.
Yeah, so, true. Well, anyway. And out here, of course, out here, you've been out here. We still have combines slide down the hill. Matter of fact, about a mile from my house this summer, we had a gleaner combine that got out of control and went all the way down into the ditch. So, and that was a fairly new combine. So those things still happen. So,
I've combined in the Skyrockets before.
Oh, yep.
It's scary, and I'm not going to make any jokes about that because I worry about the safety of farmers. But it's wonderful wheatland to farm out there. Just incredible country. If I was ever not going to farm in the Corn Belt, in an I state in the Corn Belt, I'd be in the Palouse so fast.
We were pushing.
See my dust behind me.
Yeah, we were pushing 170, 175 bushel on dryland wheat last year. Of course, that was soft white, but still 170 bushel wheat, you can make some money on that. So
you sound just like a landlord, Paul. You probably only remember the 230 on the yield monitor when you see corn, and you don't remember the 95 bushel and 45 bushel corn we had after the Islander ratio last year.
Yeah, exactly. No, I was out there when we were harvesting some of that. I got to shell some corn. So
there you go.
And we're going to take a quick break, but we'll be back in a moment with more of the Farm CPA podcast.
Get timely updates about taxation, accounting, succession planning, and other issues that are unique to farmers and agribusiness processors. Find out about major agribusiness events and how to comply with new laws that affect your business. Subscribe to Farm CPA at blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness and experience the CLA promise. blogs.claconnect.com/agribusiness.
Welcome back to the Farm CPA podcast. We're going to continue our conversation with Ben Rinchey. So, over the 20, almost 30 year career that you've had now as farming, because I think you said you started in, it wouldn't be that long. You said 93, is that when you came back to the farm?
Well, I only went to college twice and I had a math class both times, and this would be my 28th crop, Paul.
Okay. I always like to ask, for farmers that have grown fairly, maybe not rapidly, but have certainly been on a growth mode. Why did you do it? B, what do you think you did right or wrong? And then would you do any of it over?
Sure. Well, this is all going to be relative to the period I did it in. And history never repeats itself, but it often rhymes. I am pleased myself that I was always an asset buyer. Yes, I rent more land than I own to farm, but I have a more substantial owned land base than most farmers. And I've never been afraid of buying assets if I can see that they provide a return. And, you know, when I look back and I look back at my banker peers who stick with banking, and quite frankly, you know, my odometer is going to roll over this year and quit starting with a 5. It's going to start with a 6. And a lot of them are viewing the light at the end of the tunnel. And, you know, they make great pay along the way, but, you know, there's a lot of things to spend money on between payday and retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to argue with the sort of satisfaction you get from accumulating assets along the way. Now, that doesn't guarantee you cash flow in any way, shape, or form, but, it, you know, it is nice to have some assets that you own yourself, farmland equipment that you can count on, that you don't have to renegotiate every year. It makes you more of an investor than a deal maker every year. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad for the asset accumulation that's occurred over my farming career.
So even when you said it had a return, the return may not have covered your debt service completely, but it still provided a return that over time, you know, it exceeded your debt service. Is that sort of how you approached it? Because I know a lot of times farmer will tell me, well, that buying that land is too expensive because I can't make the payment. Well, we got to remember part of the payment is interest. Yeah, that's an expense. But a lot of that payment for a lot of farms, especially if it's a fairly accelerated payment schedule, is really a principal. You're making an investment. So I'm just curious, you know, with your banker brain, how are you looking at some of those investments that, quote, might not have paid for themselves from the get-go?
Yeah. Well, that's why you have to make sure everything's profitable so that you've got the ability to invest in things that will eventually have capital gains. Now, yep. A wise man once told me that you can never pay too much for a farm, but you can pay it too soon. And first of all, I'm not going to tell anybody, you know, a decade or three younger than me that you got to go out and buy a lot of fixed assets right away. But I'd certainly want to operate in a way that provided enough cash flow that I could peel some away to make fixed asset investments.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's interesting you pose this question, because if you pulled up my balance sheet right now, my market value balance sheet, I have done just as well working as I have owning agricultural assets. If you would take the value of my equipment and grain facilities, which probably wouldn't sell in the marketplace for what they cost to build, but in farmland, certainly farmland, half my net worth today has come from owning assets and having them appreciate, and half has come from the actual work of farming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So if you're asset light, you're only going to see half of that. You might have had more capital, though, to expand on a wider scale, but I don't know if I'm really interested in just having more at this point. That's for the next generation of my farm. That's for my son-in-law, and that's for my son when at some future date, and any of my three daughters that might be coming back to join our operation in the future. So,
and speaking of that, you know, succession planning, we've sort of had a, you know, I had met your dad the first time I was there, and I knew he was still farming, and I heard that he passed. Has those assets been transferred to you, or are they still with your mother if she's still living? Or, you know, what's your process and as far as bringing in your next generation?
Yeah, well, there's a few rules about that. First of all, we've got the 5-year rule, and I don't want any of my children, and this even applied to my son-in-law, Luke. He he and my oldest daughter, Lauren, have been entwined for a long time. They had plans to go to college and get early careers, and that they dated a long time back to high school. And it wasn't always on the drawing board for Luke to come to our farm, but it just worked out so. And I'm glad Luke had 5 years experience with Farm Credit Services and Rabo AgriFinance before mm-hmm. he came to our farm. That made him much better. My son, who's going to go work for Aimpoint Research in Columbus, Ohio, I hope he brings back skills someday that we don't have. The last thing I need is my kids here repeating my bad habits and mistakes. I want them to go out and learn about agronomy, ag business, technology, whatever. My middle daughter, Hannah, has worked for Bayer and now for BASF. She's engaged to be married to a fine young man, and his family has an incredible farm in Southeast Iowa, and I'm sure she'll be a great asset to that farm in the future. And yeah. My youngest daughter, Faith, took a gap year for college and will start college this fall. And she always claims she's going to come back and be the boss of her brother. So, fine with me.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you bring that up because, you know, although my career has really been related to being a CPA, my oldest son, when he was in high school, said, "Dad, you know, I'm going to become a CPA. I can come work with you." And I kept saying, "Son, you know, you need to get your college career, get your degree. If you want to start off as CPA, start off somewhere else. You know, find out if you really like it." And now he's a real estate developer. He still uses his skills from being a CPA, but he is not a practicing CPA. And then my second son started as a CPA. They both started at PwC. He was an international tax, and after about 3 years he goes, "You know, Mom, Dad, I really don't like this." And now he's a professional daily fantasy sports player and podcaster and blogger and writer and is really having a great time. So, and both my wife and I, we want our kids to be successful, but we don't want them to be our success. We want them to be their success, and that's what's important.
Yeah, I agree. And there's a couple of questions that you posed that are left hanging, and your own experience in the accounting business provides great segue for that. The first is, what would you do over if you could do it over? And I will point out that bankers and CPAs both tend to be people who have their nose in their book and their tail to the future. And I followed. Probably if I go back, I wouldn't follow the rules as closely as I did. Mm-hmm. On some of the things sorry, that was meant to burn just a little bit, Paul. But by serving on some boards and councils you make a wider circle of friends. You lengthen your runway for opportunities. You hear about things to do, and you get a chance to watch others, and really marvel at producers who are in kind of what we'll call the High Plains geography. Some producers that I've been on boards with in the Dakotas, in Kansas, in particular, places that they didn't exactly have our I-state markets and production capabilities. They had to develop their opportunities. They built livestock production facilities, and they found markets and attracted corporate partners to their farms to buy their production. Ethanol plants, they didn't know the banker account rules, so they didn't follow them, and they went with their ideas and what they like to do with reckless abandon, and they went for broke and they didn't make it. They did very well instead. And so I'd probably take a little more risk if I was going to go back over time, especially early in my career. I mean, I spent the first 10 years of my career in the banks kind of shackled by a very expensive farmland purchase I made. Not only did I have all this tuition to eat, but I also had an expensive farm to eat over that time. But I don't know. It was like training, you know, toughened me up, you know. If I'd kept my capital rested another 5 years in my 20s, I probably could have bought farms for cash, you know, but we'll never know.
Right.
But I do marvel at those who kind of cultivate and make their own opportunities. I wish that, you know, I worried about the cost structure of farming commodity corn and soybeans and my production system and production technology. And in retrospect, I really envied and enjoyed those who made their own set of opportunities.
Yep.
And then the other question that's kind of hanging out there is what happens with my dad's estate? And the thing is, Paul, I've been blessed with enough prosperity that that it just really doesn't make sense to move his assets to me. Those are destined to go right to the next generation. They'll just hopscotch over me, and you'd be more at liberty to discuss the sorts of generation skipping opportunities and tax savings you can have by doing that. But the idea there is just skip over my generation, my sister and I, and take them right to the kids.
Yeah. And speaking of estate taxes and so on, and, you know, not that I expect you to know a lot about the proposals out there, you know, the step back and the 99.5% Act and so on, but you've probably have maybe either read some of the blog posts or I've seen some in the news. Is that something that concerns you that, you know, maybe at your death, you're going to have to owe a capital gains tax that your kids are going to have to pay eventually, or doing transfers during life? Is that something that concerns you or not?
Well, it's probably inevitable, isn't it? This winter, I've spent a lot of time with folks who have been very successful in other parts of business outside of agriculture that were interested in owning farmland as an investment. And one of the most telling comments, I asked a retired executive who has a background in data technology and computing, why he wanted to buy a farm or farms. And he said that if he owned agricultural assets, it'd probably take the government a long time to figure out how to squeeze the money out of them and tax it away from them. That the primary concern he had on his mind was that there has been a huge shift in what people expect from their government. Mm-hmm. Not that we didn't have a whole lot of obligation in the past, but during the pandemic and that, I mean, look at the stimulus checks, you know, Alphabet Soup, EIDLL, PPP. Yeah. Man, the handouts just keep coming, and one of two things is either going to happen. The printing presses are going to roll to make that money. And last time I checked, when you play Monopoly, don't you get about $1,000 and Park Place is $100?
Yeah.
And so if we hand everybody else another $1,000, doesn't Park Place just go up to $200?
Or 300 or 400, yep, yep.
Well, you know, maybe it's not even a linear relationship. Maybe we print we doubled the money supply, maybe prices more than double. But, and that could happen because, you know, prior debts and obligations become, insignificant. And so inflation could be greater than the rate of printing money.
Yep.
So, the smarter than me folks that are interested in buying farmland thought one of two things, either farmland and farm assets, livestock facilities, grain storage goes up in value because of the inflationary effect, or it's not as quick as, you know, the government doesn't have as quick a path as wages to just taxing wages and savings to take it away from you. Now,
yeah.
At least if it's the state taxes, you've got a long, long time to plan a route around that, let's hope.
Right.
Unless you're gonna be pushing daisies sooner than we think.
Yeah.
So
now, and that's what I tell a lot of people is you know, if you work on your estate tax planning, time is your most valuable asset. You have the ability to make changes, to structure it appropriately, and so on. So and I think some of these acts, you know, some of it might happen, some of it may not. But I think the key is, you know, relax, we'll be able to handle it, whatever it might be, we'll be able to handle it. So,
Paul,
we're getting close. Go ahead.
Paul, I don't mean to be patronizing, but out of good friends that are other very successful farming and ranching operations, the most frequent conversation on this subject I have with them is that they underestimate how big their businesses had grown,
mm-hmm.
and that they used their local attorney or they used their local bookkeeper for sort of a tax plan, estate plan, and they didn't reach out. And I didn't intend to be patronizing, but I know you're very professional at this, Paul, and with one of the handful of firms that is very good at what you do. And they didn't make the switch to getting the caliber of advice and plan they needed soon enough. And they end up with this sort of locked into a lot of small-minded thinking about a very big problem.
Mm-hmm.
And they can spend a lot of time trying to unwind it and get moved over to a very successful strategy. And it usually comes after the cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And it's like they just don't have time to get out of it.
Yeah. And I guess when I stated that we have plenty of time, that doesn't mean we can procrastinate. You know, that's the one problem I see with estate planning is people say, well, I got 20 or 30 years. I can worry about it, you know, 20 or 30 years from now. Well, no, you need to deal with it now. You need to be planning. Because like you say, you don't know when you're going to get that cancer diagnosis, or even like myself, you know, I think I've been relatively healthy, but you know, 3 months ago I had a bad bout of COVID, and you know, my wife a couple different times thought I was going to die. Now I didn't think I was that far along, but maybe I was. You know, you just don't know. So life happens, but you need to plan for it, and that's what I think us farmers or us taxpayers, especially us guys, at times, you know, we don't want to plan for that type of, result or eventuality. So that's something we got to be careful of.
I agree. You don't know when your time is up. So all I'm going to say is if you think you've got a good enough estate tax plan, it doesn't hurt to ask someone who is very sophisticated at that to look things over for you.
Yeah.
And probably doesn't cost you much if any to have that done. Volunteering services from people like you for free, Paul.
And but, you're right. I think
lessons learned from my dad. I don't intend to be 90 years old and still, you know, be writing checks on a Wednesday and go on a Friday. It's been very unwinding things my dad was still involved in, like EQIP and CSP contracts. And my dad, was always a very aggressive, non-ag investor, had a nice portfolio of things besides agriculture. But by the same token, when you could buy a new combine for 1.9 money and keep your money in the stock market, that's what he did. And this has been very this has been very challenging for my mother, who could live on $650 a year and drive her 1989 Chrysler Town and Country van and be happy. You know, when she gets the bill for the Hoffman farm, she freaks out. Why do we have dad on a farm? Well, because dad kept the money in the stock market and it grew 30% last year. And by the way, the farm went up in value too, but you've got 2.9% money at farm credit on the purchase price. Well, this seems all very threatening and confusing to my mother.
Exactly. Well, I think we're getting close to the end here. I got a couple more questions for you. One question is there anything that really keeps you up at night that you worry about?
Well, I think we've covered that ground. I want to be more proactive in transitioning. I'm nowhere close to being done farming. In fact, I've watched a few of my friends kind of like shift down a couple of gears, and that's just not for me. I just need to shift roles in my, I have a good friend who bought a house in Florida this winter, and he made a comment to me, what do you do after the second week of doing nothing? You know, and that's just never going to be me. I mean, I'm going to wear out. I'm not going to rust out. And, but on the other hand, my dad stayed in it too long, on the front line, and I got to figure out somewhere in between to be where I coach and transfer skills and manage opportunities that are greater than what you can earlier in your career and make sure I get those into our farm. Interesting. You asked me about farming 100 miles away from the home to north. We figured out the wheels rolled the other way and we've expanded to the south, and we're in the process of, and in that we picked up another grain facility that we partnered with another farm on, and that got blown down the derecho, and we're rebuilding that with our business partners there. So we've expanded two directions, so managing that, transitioning, being the best senior partner in our business that I can be, those things keep me up at night.
And then my last question, and it's what I always end with, is what is your definition of success in farming?
Well, our prior president, there was a quote about him after, I believe after the convention, it said, you can't fake good kids. And, you know, farming is just something I do to have cash flow to raise my kids. So, you know, you can't. You know, I don't know what kind of tractors my grandpa farmed with. I saw a picture of a two-cylinder John Deere and an old International, or it was new International at the time. And, you know, my dad with a Massey combine and, you know, iron and every latest fad isn't important to me. My, you know, making sure that my kids get off on the right foot is the primary concern here, Paul.
Totally agree. I think consensus of me doing the podcast is that that comes through loud and clear. So, well, again, Ben, thanks for taking your time out of, I know you're getting close to, or at least you're doing spring work, and I know that can be a busy time. And I thank you for taking that time today to go over your farm and your career.
Well, it's fun, Paul. Take care and thank you. I'm flattered.
You're welcome. Thanks, Ben. Thanks for listening to today's podcast. I'm Paul Niefer, and we'll be back next week with a new episode of the Farm CPA podcast with Top Producer.